Tape 2, Side 2, continuing our interview. All right.
Outside of that, I don't think there were any like family vacations.
Well, you have to tell them that you never had a weekend off in the summertime.
That's right. Most of the summer weekends.
Ever.
So, once in a while I have an open frame. I would take the children every Sunday morning to my mother's for lunch.
The zoo.
And then to the zoo, and on the merry-go-round, and on the train, and then I'd bring them back. Outside of that, because of the work schedule being the way it is, we just didn't go.
He really didn't spend much time with the children.
No.
After supper.
After dinner, yeah. I had great help at home.
Talk a little bit, if you will, about your life, say, if there was any, in this country, any experiences of anti-Semitism here. We won't talk about Vienna, what happened there, but here, anything that...
Well, in the very beginning, no one in this country, both Jews and Gentiles, would believe that anybody could be in jail for no good reason at all, and that you would be asked to leave the place where you were born and leave everything there. Anti-Semitism here... I didn't particularly experience any, because you were so segregated anyway. I mean, you never, in our group of high school friends, let's say, there weren't any Gentiles. Except in class, once in a while, yes, you would date somebody who wasn't Jewish. And my sister did, and it really upset my father. And I think it's because of that she broke up with him. He was Greek Orthodox. Super nice guy, handsome, great manners. But we segregated ourselves, and so did they. And so, I don't think there was any...
No overt anti-Semitism.
No, I don't think so.
And professionally not.
Ah, that's a different story. Well, my father had red hair and was reasonably good looking. And a lot of people didn't know that he was Jewish. It didn't matter, but he didn't hide it, but he didn't know. They didn't know. So the first patrons that we had when Clarence Burley sold it to Mrs. Deacon and my father were the same people that came to them before, and that was called Pittsburgh Society. I tell you this in a nice way, the Jewish people didn't find us until the late 40s and early 50s, because they had their own photographer. There was a photographer named Sisman who photographed all the old Jewish families when they were in the Hill District. He was a very good photographer. Then when the Jews moved to Squirrel Hill, he moved to Squirrel Hill. So they had their photographer. And the Jewish community did not find us until they found out that we were photographing, W.C. Robinson and the Melons and the Scaife, so they must be good enough for us if he's good enough for them. And a lot of them didn't know that we were Jewish. Also, in those days, in the 40s and the 50s, there were a huge amount of good photographers in the city of Pittsburgh. There was Vitarelli Siebert, there was Bachrach, there was Brecken. There was Trinity Court. If you go to the Road of Sholem on the second floor where the offices are, you'll see these old photographs of the board. The oldest ones, the best ones, are made by Trinity Court, W.R. Johnson, great photographer. So there was a huge amount of competition. And then when my father and the woman that he bought the studio, Mrs. Deacon, split, and she opened up a studio in town, there was Florence Fisher Perry, who had four studios in downtown Pittsburgh. So there was a huge competition. And it wasn't easy for a Jew, whether he was known as a Jew or not. They didn't hire him because he was Jewish. They hired him because they wanted to, what he could do. So, but, you know, in those days, Pittsburgh Golf Club, or for that matter, there weren't any Jewish people in there. Still aren't. Maybe one. Maybe.
Token.
They don't even want a token. They don't need them. They don't need them. We don't have them. You don't have any Jewish members of non-Jewish members of Concordia, right? Right. So that's it. That's the answer.
But the Duquesne Club is open wide.
They're wide open. Why? Because they need you. I mean, it's simple. They're doing fine, but now everybody needs you. And there were so many good photographers that they really had the choice of many. And if they liked what you made, then it really almost didn't matter, because you weren't going to be friends. You were just going to be together for the wedding, which is 6 hours tops, or you were going to be together for the sitting, which is 20 minutes tops. And it's the same that Jewish doctors didn't have a huge problem either if they had a great specialty. If they were very good and they didn't care that you were Jewish, you just fix me, and then we're not going to invite you for dinner, but I don't want to be invited for dinner. I don't need it. And because of this great competition, there was the non-Jewish photographers, which there were many of, the only one that was Jewish was a woman who worked for my father for a few years, and then she also opened up her own place. Her name was Bruckner, and her brother was Judge Ellenbogen. Okay. And she opened up on Oliver Avenue on the second floor. And
where was your studio at that time?
We were in East Liberty. The one that they bought in 1941 was on the second floor at 6016 Penn Avenue. And then in 1945, when I was in the Army, the people that owned the building had a shoe store, and they wanted the whole building. So he went around the corner to Center Avenue, next door to Jack Henney. Henney's had been there since the Spanish-American War, and even before. And they had the best, greatest clientele. So we sort of fed off each other. If you go to Henny's, then you can go next door to Jonas, you know, that sort of thing. And we would not carry sterling silver frames, and they wouldn't carry non-frames. So that, and we're friends to this day. In the late 70s, there was a holdup at Henny's. They had a huge inventory. And that's when they decided they have to move out of East Liberty. So we decided we're going to go together. Would be nice if we went together. It could be a great PR thing. You know, Jonas and Henny have been neighbors since 45. Now we're going to be together in Shady Side. Anyway, it didn't work out. because we couldn't find a location that was big enough for both of us. And at one time we did find a house right off of Walnut Street. And so Jack Henny and I went to see an architect, and this is an old dilapidated house, and he said, well, what do you want? And Jack and I said, well, we'd like to have the jewelry store on the first floor and the second, third floor be the studio and all that. He said, well, how much money do you want to spend? And we said, well, what about $50,000? And the architect looked at us and said, well, for that kind of money, I'll probably clean up the front yard. So, and then we couldn't wait any longer. He couldn't wait any longer. And he moved in 78. And he moved into a building where there was a studio on the second floor. And there was a fellow named Kaleo. And with a C, C-A-L-E-O or something like that. He was in Shadyside before Shadyside was Shadyside. And
where did Henny move to? Walnut Street?
Filbert and Walnut. Mm-hmm. And that's where Jack Henny rented the downstairs location from Mr. Kaleo. So just before he moved in, he said, why don't you call him up, you know him, and see if he wants to retire. He had a heavy Italian accent, so he had very few contacts in the photographic community, but he knew my father. So, and I called him up, and I said to Mr. Kaleo, you know, like you never call your parents' friends by their first name, no matter how old you get. And I said, how would you like to retire? Because Jack Henny and I would buy your building. It'd be great. We would have like a common reception room downstairs. He would have his jewelry store straight back, and I would have the studio on the second and third floor, the second floor, which was made for it. It had all the plumbing, all the wiring. So he said, well, let me think about that. And he called me back a couple of days later, and he said, well, I'll tell you something. I'm even worse than your father. I said, what do you mean? He says, we don't have any children. It's just my wife and I. And if I couldn't come here every day and just do something, what would I do all day? So I don't think so. And I said, fine. And Jack Henny moved in with the proviso that he would have right of first refusal if the building was ever to be sold. And subsequently, Mrs. Kaleo died, and then he died a couple of years later. And about 5 years ago, Jack Henny called me, and he said, you know, there were nieces and nephews who owned the building, and he said, they want to sell it. Do you want to move? I said, no, I'm too old to move. I've moved already, and where I am, it's very nice. I'm between St. Paul's Cathedral and the museum. I'm between the two universities, and it's not a big street, and it's fine. I like it. It's close to here. So that's worked out all right.
I enjoy walking by it all the time, seeing the pictures in the windows.
I should change them a little more often.
Yeah, for me.
I know, for anybody.
How about the kinds of things? How about any political involvement, short of voting? Which?
No. No, I don't think either I or my father ever took a public position because it wouldn't be wise. From a business point of view, it isn't that a good idea to, if you live in Pittsburgh and you want to do business with the city, let's say, and I don't, but you better be a registered Democrat.
You know? I don't know after today whether you move it or not.
That's the county, and that's a wise decision, I think, to give somebody else opportunity. No, not particularly. In the early days, there was a club called the Friendship Club, which the refugees all had, and they gathered. And they would help each other in whatever way is necessary. But their children didn't continue this. There was no political or involvement.
How about involvement in the community, in any Jewish organization or something of that sort?
You know, we're all members of B'nai B'rith. They need you. They need your support. They need your money. They need to go to Congress and say, here, we got 12 million members or 6 million members. Became important, especially because of Izzy Benstock and Dorothy being so extremely active.
Mm-hmm.
You know, photographically we do things for organizations in a quiet way, because if you make it too public, then everybody wants you to do it. So...
You remember B'nai Israel, I think you said earlier.
Yes, we joined B'nai Israel when we came to East Liberty, and we were there. I went to Hebrew school there and Sunday school, and so did the children.
And now you face a problem of what to do.
It's for sale. But then the Jews on the Hill District must have faced the same problem in the early 30s.
Yes. Rosh Hashanah was downtown.
Right.
At one time.
Right. And... Temple Sinai was in Oakland.
I had lunch with Dorothy the other day. We were at a luncheon together. And she said she had not yet made a determination of where she was going to go.
Yeah. You know, it's a big schlep for her out to Fox Chapel. Besides, I think B'nai Israel is going to be the new B'nai Israel. It's going to be young people who have children, who are going to have bar mitzvahs, and, you know, they need that. And that whole North Hill section is wide open to them. And,
she's been through that.
That's right. Yeah, we don't need that.
I think our loyalty is like to the building now. Our loyalty is to the building.
And the memories in the building.
That's right. And if it's not in the building, then we can go anyplace. That's how I feel about it personally. Because I was confirmed there. My parents were there. My Zadie was there. We go back a long time.
You talked a little bit about your war experiences, but only very briefly. They were short.
I killed Hitler. Yeah. You didn't hear about that, did you? No.
Tell me more.
I went into the
Not
army.
Not soon enough.
They immediately, at that time, it was, February of 1945. Right. And they needed infantry. They didn't need anything else. At that time, I still spoke German well, and I could read and write. I can get along in German today. The problem is I don't have anybody to practice on. And I'll buy a magazine, a German magazine, at the Pitt bookstore. It takes me hours to read an article because there are many words that I don't remember. But they needed infantry, so I went to Camp Landing for basic training, and I came out, went overseas immediately, and the war was just ending. And prior to going overseas, looking at my record, the Army, in its infinite wisdom, saw that I could speak German, and they sent me to the Presidio of Monterey to learn Japanese in 6 weeks. Well, you know how much Japanese you can learn in 6 weeks. And we were in Okinawa overnight and Iwo Jima overnight, and then we went straight to Korea. And we were the first troops into Korea after the surrender. And the first thing they needed was a government. So what the army did, and this was wise, they took people and they made them in a town. This lieutenant became chief of police, this one became head of the fire department, and this one became charge of education, just to get things moving again. And they took a Korean counterpart, and he worked with this man, and so the government started, you need the electricity turned on. And in Korea at that time, Korean was not spoken. Everything was in Japanese. Because when the Japanese took over Korea, they tried to wipe out the Korean language and the Korean history. They made everything Japanese. And as a matter of fact, Koreans had to take Japanese names if they wanted to work within the government. That's, of course, changed. So my first job really was, they didn't need any more infantry. I was in the military government in Busan, just in the personnel department. And for about 6 weeks. And once the government got going and the electricity turned on again, and then I applied for a transfer to the Signal Corps, and I became an army photographer, and I documented for 24th Corps, which was our headquarters in Seoul. I would document certain aspects of the occupation. For 4 weeks, I was detached to the Navy. A lot of Koreans were sent as, quote, slave labor to China to work. So repatriating them and the families became a story that needed to be documented.
Okay, sure.
So I did that. Then during the war, when U.S. pilots would bomb Japan, they couldn't make it back to the ship or from wherever they came from. So they would fly on to China and try to land there somewhere. Well, some of them didn't make it. And some were to Manchuria. And if they ran out of fuel or were killed or shot down, one of the projects that I was on for, I think it was 30 days, we had a train that left Seoul with a group of pathologists and interpreters, and we had our own dining car. There were about 12 of us. And we were on the grave registration detail. We went to Manchuria all the way up almost to Mukden, through North Korea into Manchuria on this train, to find the grave sites of American pilots, photograph them, and take the remains. And that, now the 25th Russian Army had occupied North Korea and all of Manchuria. And so when we crossed the 38th parallel, we took on a Russian personnel, and they attached themselves on our train, but we had our own food, and then they would take us to Pyongyang, and they had their USO entertain us. We would be guests of the Russian government, you know, and that was interesting. The Russian soldiers would bring their wives. And they had a terrible life. I mean, it was just very almost brutal. They had very little food. They lived off the land. They You know, we would give them our playing cards because they wore theirs out, you know. But, I remember this Russian colonel, he said, when we went to their USO, which was an evenings of entertainment, and he apologized for the poor quality of the magician or the dancers. He says, what do you think? You know, this is all the way across Siberia. We get the worst of everything. So, I learned.
Unusual experience.
Yes. We also were told that anybody that can bring along a 25th Russian Army phone book would get 30 days vacation. They wanted to see the strength of the Russians. And if you could get a hold of a phone book, you know, then you would see it, of course. So.
30 days vacation in Siberia or Manchuria.
No, it wasn't a thrill. And I spent the rest of the army time in photography. Headquarters was in Seoul, but you were never there. You just went there to get film or cameras or to Yokohama, which was the port of entry in Japan where all the materials came. So we'd go there and pick up supplies and then whatever needed to be done.
And you stay there how long? When did you return?
November of 46. I had accumulated a lot of time and I was discharged just a few days before Christmas of 46.
And you were married?
In 51.
It took me a long time. We dated all that time, even from freshman high school.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about some of the achievements that you feel you have had in your career, in your life.
In the early 50s, my father had a friend in Houston, Texas, who was a very good photographer, also a very good businessman. And his name was Paul Linwood Giddings. And they had a mutual friend here in Pittsburgh who was a photographer named Richard Little. And that's how my father got in with Paul Giddings. And he invited me to Texas, and I was, this was in the middle 50s, I saw the studio, it was, you know, had a $5,000 carpet on the floor. I mean, that was a lot of money. He was in Houston and in Dallas and in Fort Worth and he had and in New Orleans and in Colorado too. And road crews in between that would cover the territory. And that was when Texas was really great and oil was making a lot of money. And so were they. And I spent a weekend with them, and then Mr. Giddings said, you know, how would you like to come to work for us here? And he had a studio at the Galleria, I mean, which was unheard of in our business, to have such a high-priced location next to Tiffany's. So I came back and I said to my father, you know, Mr. Giddings would like, offered me a job. He wants me to go work for him. And my father said, well, you know, you want to go to Texas and spell your name for people? go right ahead. So, and Paul Sr. had a son who was extremely inept, and he was so afraid that this would, and he was right. When he died, the studio lasted about 6 months, and this is, went bankrupt. Mm. I mean, totally bankrupt. And his wife was so upset by all this that she decided that if it was ever sold, it would be sold for a dollar, but you had to pay all the debts. And there's a fellow two or three years ago who bought it, maybe longer, and his name is Skipworth, and I saw him at a meeting in Atlanta last February. And he said, it's the worst thing I ever did in my life. I didn't know that you could pour so much money down the drain as I am. It was just terribly... And you can't have a chain of fine studios anymore. You can, but it's extremely difficult. Because if you're a good photographer, all the darkroom work can be done at outside labs. You don't need to know everything anymore.
End of take two. Side 2, to be continued. We've been here.
Okay.
So we make another date. We're good. Almost through. There's not that much All more right. to do.
Okay.